Hello again. I'm Kathleen Dunn. You are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Thursday, snowy Thursday here in Milwaukee. We have a delightful book to talk about this hour. It's Harry Truman's excellent adventure, The True Story of a Great American Road Trip. Matthew Algio is our guest. Shortly after Truman left the presidency, he went back to Missouri, as you know, and he was incredibly broke. I mean, this we'll talk more about how little money he had, but the guy had no money at all. There weren't any presidential pensions. He had an army pension, I think, but that was about it. He and Bess, Harry loved cars. Actually, the first quote of the book is, "I like roads. I like to move." He liked cars. He liked to drive in cars. And, of course, he also liked to walk. And they took this trip without Secret Service, thinking that they could go with nobody noticing them from Missouri across the country, the eastern part of the country, through Illinois to Washington, up to New York to see their daughter Margaret, and back again. And it's a great telling of that story, which Matthew recreated. He went through that trip himself. But it's filled with information about what was going on in America during that period of time, how Truman was treated when he met people along the road, and also information about what was going on with Democratic politics and what he thought of various presidents and what various presidents and others thought of him. It's a great read. Matthew is with us this hour of the program, and we'll be welcoming phone calls for him. He joins us by phone from Italy, of all places. It's wonderful to imagine Italy as we're experiencing this blizzard here in Milwaukee. Well, welcome phone calls as we talk about Harry Truman and the excellent adventure. Our number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Or if you'd like to send an email, you are ever so welcome to do that. That's talk@WPR.org, talk@WPR.org. Hello, Matthew.
Hi, Kathleen.
What are you doing in Italy when we're having a blizzard in Milwaukee?
I'm too embarrassed to say what the weather's like here right now.
Okay.
But my wife actually works for the State Department. She's a Foreign Service officer.
Oh, she is.
I'm sorry?
Oh, she is. That's interesting.
Yeah. She's an American diplomat. So we were lucky enough to get posted here for 2 years. Now, in the interest of full disclosure, we just found out the next post will be Mongolia. which is probably even colder than Wisconsin right now, so it all evens out.
It does. Oh, well, good for you. That's quite an experience.
I just really loved
your book. It's so well done, and you wove in so much history in the book. I thought it was just going to be a travel adventure, but it's a lot of politics and what was going on at that time and his workings in the Democratic Party and what he thought of presidents. It was just a lot of interesting information.
Well, thank you. It's just a really great little story. And I thought the book would be a good chance to kind of expand on this little story and tell some bigger stories along the way. And I was lucky because there were some opportunities in there for me to be able to do that. So hopefully I did it pretty well.
Yeah, you did do it very well. The thing that was striking to me, and I knew this about him, was how broke this guy was when he left the presidency. He had no money.
It is hard to believe, but at that time, 1953, as you mentioned, ex-presidents did not receive pensions. And Harry Truman, really, he'd never been anything but a politician. Now, back in the early 20s, he opened up a haberdashery in Kansas City, but that went under. There was an economic recession in the country, and he lost that. And so his only jobs, really, were political jobs. And even though they seemed to pay very well, especially when he was president, at the time, out of the presidential salary, which I believe it was $100,000 when he left office, presidents were expected to pay all the expenses of operating the White House. And so he was able to save very little money through his political career. And when he left office, you're right, his only income was an army pension. It was $111.96 a month.
My goodness.
And he didn't qualify for Social Security because he had been a government employee and didn't pay into the Social Security fund. And also, he left Congress the year before Congress gave itself pensions. So he was really in a financial bind when he left office in '53.
And was moving back to a house that probably needed a bit of work, right?
You know, he didn't. That was the first house that he and Bess had ever owned. And they only bought the house in 1952 when Bess's mother passed away, and then Harry and Bess bought out her two brothers' share in the house. And it was a slightly ramshackle Victorian on Delaware Street in Independence, Missouri. And there was speculation when he left office that he might move to New York or Long Island or Key West, where he had vacationed a lot. But he always insisted that, no, I'm going back home to Independence. And part of it was principle, but part of it was practical. They couldn't afford to move anywhere else. This was the only house they could afford to retire to. And so there were really practical reasons for him to go back to Independence.
And part of it was Bess, I would imagine, too.
Yeah, Bess never really liked Washington a lot, and in fact spent a lot of time away from Washington. Even when Harry became president, Bess would spend months at a time back at the house in Independence. I mean, Bess wasn't crazy about Harry being nominated for vice president in 1944. She already thought the family was spending way too much time away from Independence, and the thought of him becoming vice president to her, she wasn't pleased with that. And then, of course, he only served some 80-some days as vice president and then became president when Roosevelt died. But Bess continued to return to Independence quite frequently, and so that was where her heart was always, and right. Is another one of the reasons they went back there.
You talk about the lucrative offers that he had, though, some commercial offers. Why didn't he take any of those?
He believed that he should do nothing that would, in his words, commercialize the presidency. He didn't want to do anything that was simply trading on the fact that he had been president. There was some clothing store that offered him $100,000 a year to be a quote-unquote sales representative. It was just a make-believe job. They would have him go to department stores and that sort of thing. There was a company that wanted to name a brand of soap after him, Truman Soap. So he had all kinds of crazy and some very lucrative business offers, but it was his belief that he should not do anything that would make it appear he was cashing in on his status as a former president or accept any position which was offered simply because he was a former president. And so he declined all of these offers, and really, it's as we know, it's an example that has not withstood the test of time, let's put it that way.
It sure hasn't withstood it. What a change after he became the president and subsequent presidents. He loved cars, didn't he? It's no wonder that he decided to do a car trip, because he probably loved cars as much, if not more, than he loved walking.
He was really one of the true car-loving presidents. He loved to drive. When he was in the Senate, that's how he commuted back and forth between Independence and Washington. And in fact, when it came time for him to take this trip in 1953, even though he hadn't done the trip in 8 years, he was very familiar with the route. When he campaigned for the United States Senate for his first campaign in 1934, he just drove all over Missouri in his car. I believe it was a Plymouth. And he wrote Bess, he said it was like being on vacation to him. This was not work. He loved to drive so much. He loved cars. He loved the gadgets on cars. He loved flashy cars. And so it was no surprise that when he went back to Independence, one of the first things he did was buy this car, a 1953 Chrysler New Yorker.
And you drove one of those cars, didn't you?
Yeah, I did. The real original Harry's 1953 Chrysler New Yorker apparently is out there somewhere. And I have a couple leads. I'm still trying to track it down. I wasn't able to find it in time to write about it for the book. But in my quest, I found another guy who owns a 53 New Yorker. He lives in Maryland, a very nice guy. And I drove out there one day, and Alan Hayes is his name, and he was nice enough to let me take it for a little spin. And I'll tell you, it was pretty scary driving. It's a behemoth. These cars were enormous. And a lot of the things didn't work quite as well as we're accustomed to today. It had a early version of power steering, but and the brakes are a little iffy. But yeah, it was kind of neat to at least get some idea of what it felt like to be behind the wheel of Harry's New Yorker.
So the car is out there somewhere. You would think somebody would come forward and say, "Here's Harry's car. Let's put it in the museum."
A couple people have, and the museum the museum component is the big thing. The Truman Library, which is it's a great place, and they were so helpful to me. One of the curators there does know the whereabouts of the car, but they're hoping that eventually the owner will donate it to the museum, and they don't want to do anything that might jeopardize that transaction.
I see.
And so when I asked, can you tell me where the car is, they said they'd rather not, because they're really hoping to eventually get that car back in the museum.
Which is where it should be.
Yeah.
So was it scary to be behind the wheel with Harry?
Yeah. Harry, although he loved to drive, the consensus seems to be he was not a very good driver. And, of course, like all of us, I guess he thought he was a great driver. But he did get in a bad accident one time driving back when he was a senator, driving back to Missouri from Washington. And the consensus really is that he drove too fast. Speed was his major problem. I mean, Bess knew he drove too fast. One of the concessions she extracted from him before taking this road trip in 1953 was that he would not drive faster than 55 miles an hour. Because she knew he always drove too fast. And this was a pretty big concession back then, too, because in many places there were no speed limits. In fact, in Missouri at the time, the posted speed limit was safe and prudent. That was how you were expected to drive. So for Harry to agree to drive 55 was quite a concession for him.
Oh, I love that. Safe and prudent.
Yeah.
Tell us a story. There are several of these stories when he got gas, et cetera. But who was the trooper who stopped him? I think he was in the left lane, and he was supposed to be in the right lane.
Yeah, he was on the Pennsylvania Turnpike. This was on the way home, actually, and it was a 4th of July weekend. And another problem with Harry's driving, he was one of these guys who would get in the left lane and stay there.
Oh, no.
And would never go over to the right lane. And so he's driving 55, which is actually slower than average for the Pennsylvania Turnpike at that time and today, and just hanging out in the left lane. And so a line of cars was piling up behind him, you know, waiting for him to move over to the right. And there was a state trooper. This was in western Pennsylvania, about 100 miles east of Pittsburgh. A state trooper, a guy by the name of Manly Stampler. A great cop name. And he saw this guy blocking traffic in the left lane and zoomed up the right lane and waved for him to pull over. And so Harry pulled over, and Manly got out of the car, went back to Harry's car, bent down and looked in the window. And I can't exactly say what Manly was thinking at the time, but right away he recognized who he had pulled over. And he's still alive. I actually was kind of cool for the book. I tried to find as many people as I could who had encounters with Harry and Bess on this trip, and I was lucky to find about a dozen. And Manly's one of them. He's retired, alive and well. He lives outside Phoenix right now. And so I was able to talk to him and ask him, you know, why he didn't give the Trumans a ticket. Harry later insisted the cop only pulled over to shake his hand, but Manly said that's not the case. And he said, you know, I wasn't going to give him a ticket. He was a former president of the United States. And then Manly thought for a second and said, well, maybe some other presidents, but not Harry Truman. So Harry was lucky he didn't get a ticket.
And that was, he drew crowds. I don't know what they were thinking when they got in this car and thought, well, we're just, you know, the former president, former first lady. Nobody will know who we are.
Obviously
people knew.
I think it was just, who was going to just travel incognito.
Right.
And it's kind of crazy. But I guess, you know, this is an interesting time in American history, too. We're sort of right at changing into what we know as the modern mass media, and television is becoming bigger and bigger. And I guess we really didn't know presidents quite as intimately as we know them now. I mean, you know, we recognize George W. Bush's walk, Barack Obama, every, you know, gesture and nuance you kind of get accustomed to. You see it over and over. Back then, you didn't see the presidents quite as much like that. You just saw their, you know, official portrait on page one when there was news about the president, that sort of thing, or very managed photo opportunities. So, but nonetheless, I mean, Harry and Bess Truman were two of the most recognizable faces in the country, so there was no way they were going to travel incognito.
And I love the stories, put us somewhere where this happened. It happened in many places where there would be party lines at that time, and they go into a little cafe to get breakfast, and all of a sudden somebody would call somebody, and everybody would show up to have a Coke.
Yeah, they stopped at a little diner in Frostburg, Maryland, in western Maryland, a place called the Princess Diner. And this is one of those places where it happened, where as soon as Harry walked in the place, of course, he was recognized. In fact, the cook there was an old Army mess sergeant, and so Harry was, you know, technically his former boss, commander-in-chief. And Frostburg did have a party line at that time, a central operator, and so they said the princess did a better business selling Cokes for that hour that Harry Truman was there having lunch than they ever had before. The princess is still there, by the way, and they have a little plaque above the booth that where Harry and Bess sat and had lunch that day way back in 1953. So if you're ever you're ever passing through Frostburg, Maryland, stop and have lunch at the Truman Booth.
I sure will.
At the Princess Restaurant.
I sure will. We're going to welcome phone calls for Matthew. He's the author of Harry Truman's Excellent Adventure, the true story of a great American road trip. And it is a wonderful story written beautifully by Matthew. There's a lot of political history involved in this book, as well as some of the more mundane things. But because it's Harry Truman, they're highly interesting. He kept track of the gas mileage for his car, and we know what they ate because he kept track of all of that. So, and Matthew went on the journey himself to see what it was like and to see if there were people still alive who remembered seeing Harry Truman and what he thought was going to be an anonymous road journey with his wife, Bess. It was anything but that, as you can imagine. Our phone number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. 8655. If you'd like to send an email, you're welcome to do that. That's talk@WPR.org. Talk@WPR.org. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We welcome phone calls now for our guest, Matthew Algio, who's joining us by phone from Italy today. Our phone number is 800-486-8655, and we start our calls with Betty from Oak Creek. Hello, Betty.
Well, thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
My husband's from Missouri, so this is really interesting because we think he's one of the greatest presidents that ever lived, and I never knew that his wife had any siblings. I always thought she was an only child.
No, she actually had two brothers. And in fact, it's kind of funny. When Harry went back to Independence, the brothers lived in two small houses around the corner from Harry. And when Harry went back to Independence, for the first few weeks, he was borrowing one of the brother-in-law's cars to get around. So that was one of the another impetus for him to go buy his own car. But I think Bess was the only daughter in the family.
I see.
And why do you think he was one of the best presidents, Betty?
He was a down-to-earth dirt farmer, I guess, because he really had a sharp mind. He could manage and think. I don't know. I just think he was very, very maybe not book smart, but very able to figure things out, because what a position he was in when he had to take over president.
Yes.
He had no idea, nothing about anything. And all of a sudden, this was thrown at him.
Yeah, it was a big thing, wasn't it? And he was only a high school graduate, but he was book smart. He was book smart on his own, right, Matthew?
Yeah, he was really probably one of our best read presidents. But you're right, he had nothing more than a high school diploma. He is the last president with nothing more than a high school diploma. And that was another one of the reasons that he had financial problems when he went back to Independence when he retired, because he didn't really have a career. He had no formal training in anything. I mean, he wasn't a lawyer like a lot of presidents are. He wasn't really a businessman. And in fact, it's funny, for a time he considered becoming a lawyer, and at that time in Missouri, you didn't have to go to law school. You only had to pass the bar exam and be accepted to the bar. And so he actually did fill out the application to be admitted to the bar in Missouri, and the Truman Library has the application, and it's funny because they ask for 9 references when you apply to the bar, and he listed the 9 justices of the United States Supreme Court. But he ultimately decided that it wouldn't be really practical for him. He'd have to recuse himself from so many cases because he had been involved in the legislation. So he didn't do that. But yeah, he had nothing more than a high school diploma.
And he did have this, not overwhelming support. There were people he ran into who hadn't voted for him. But when she talked about this down-to-earth quality of him, people felt comfortable shaking his hand, you know, hey, Harry, how are you doing? There was a rapport he had with American people, maybe because people thought he was down-to-earth guy.
It's funny how people's first reaction when seeing him would be to call him Harry. Everybody would say, hi, Harry.
Huh.
He was just a great politician. I mean, he was made for being a politician. He could talk to anybody about anything. And to a person, the people I interviewed who he met with on the trip would talk about how when Harry Truman talked to you, he made you feel like you were the most important thing in the world.
Great.
Whether you were talking about the weather to the with a service station attendant or whatever. So he did have this gift for really connecting with people in a way. And I think that that went a long way toward maintaining or actually improving his popularity. One of the things that surprised me when I did the research for the book, his approval rating when he left office was like 22%. I mean, it was not very high.
Holy cow.
And so he had a lot of work to do to kind of, you know, restore his place among, you know, as a popular politician, even in retirement. And, of course, by the time he died, he was one of the 10 most admired men in the country.
So what happened? What happened in those years?
You know, I think a lot of people, part of it was reflecting on what he had actually done as president and the sort of kind of the appreciation for that growing as his presidency became more distant. And then you're talking about, you know, at the very end of his life, Watergate's beginning. I mean, there is this cynicism that entered politics. And I think when people look back on Harry Truman, say what you want about him, but cynical is not one of the words that one would use to describe him. And I think the appreciation for that grew. He was genuine. He was who he was. And as the years passed, I think people began to realize that.
Hmm. Thanks, Betty, for your call. Our number is 800-486-8655, and we're talking this hour on the Ideas Network with the author of a wonderful book, Harry Truman's Excellent Adventure, The True Story of a Great American Road Trip. Matthew Algio is our guest. Ray from Madison, hi.
Yes, I admire President Truman for many of his qualities. But I do have a dissenting view on the end of World War II. I don't think he had enough confidence to stand up to the U.S. military, particularly the Air Force, and therefore we bombed Dresden, and we bombed Hiroshima, and we bombed Nagasaki, and these were war crimes, killing civilians on a massive scale. And I would like your comments on that.
All right.
Well, I, let's face it, these are probably the most controversial decisions that Harry Truman made. He himself didn't seem to have a problem with it in the fact that he thought they were the right decisions to make, and he had his reasons for making them. I mean, I don't know. Personally, I'm kind of torn on it. I thought it was interesting. I don't know whether you saw in the news just recently the last survivor of both the Hiroshima and Nagasaki bombings.
Yes.
Passed away, and made me think about this question again, Harry Truman. And it's a very, very difficult part of his legacy to assess, and I might even say it might even still be too soon to really know what the answer to that question is. Was it the right thing to do, or was it a crime? You know, I really don't know how to answer that.
Mm-hmm. I want to go back to what Betty said, too. It is remarkable when you think about it. I think about, because I love Abraham Lincoln, what he was walking into when he became president. It's true of Harry Truman as well, what he walked into. What was on the plate? It was phenomenal.
I mean, I guess you could say there aren't many more presidents who had to make more big decisions than Harry Truman did,
right.
And especially in that first year in office, everything from the founding of the United Nations to the ending the war in Japan and in Europe, it really is kind of amazing that this guy from Missouri, who 23 years earlier, I think it was the summer of 1922, he was 38, unemployed, and living with his mother-in-law. I mean, this was not a guy that you would expect to make history the way he made history. And a lot of it was, whatever you want to call it, fate or chance or destiny. But he ended up becoming president in 1945 and having to make those decisions. And they were hard decisions to make. And going back to the bombings in Japan, I mean, however you feel about it, in a way, you have to respect the fact that this man had a very difficult decision to make. You might think he made the wrong decision, but he made the decision, and then he had to live with it. So he faced a lot of difficult decisions in his presidency.
Right.
I mean, we're talking about McCarthyism and the Red Scare and all of this. It's just quite an extraordinary presidency.
Yeah. Speaking of McCarthyism, I want you to tell the story because it – I never thought of Eisenhower this way. The transition of power and the reason for Eisenhower and Truman's dislike for Eisenhower, but what happened in Wisconsin with playing along with McCarthy, that is Eisenhower, and then Eisenhower not going in for coffee during the transition morning. That's an incredible story.
It's Eisenhower and Truman actually got along very well during the war, and got along pretty well actually until the election in 1952 when Eisenhower ran against Stevenson. Eisenhower is a Republican, of course, and he was in Wisconsin, and I'm not sure whether it was Milwaukee or Madison, but he was giving a speech in Wisconsin. Eisenhower was, and in the speech, he had condemned. He was going to not condemn, but criticize McCarthy, Senator McCarthy. But then he decided, at the last minute, Eisenhower did, to take this part of the speech out because he was afraid of alienating McCarthy, and especially in Wisconsin. Eisenhower, his press people had already released a version of the speech to reporters, so they knew that he had redacted this bit criticizing McCarthy, and he also in the speech redacted a bit Marshall. In the speech he also criticized Marshall, but didn't criticize McCarthy. George Marshall, who was a Harry Secretary of State at the time. In any event, this infuriated Truman, who thought Eisenhower was kind of a coward for kowtowing to McCarthy, and it really did sour their relationship. And when Eisenhower showed up at the White House on January 20th, 1953, to pick up Truman for the ride to the inauguration, you're right, Eisenhower didn't even go inside for coffee. Now, this is a tradition that extended back to, I mean, you're going back to the earliest days of the presidency when the incoming president calls on the outgoing president. So it was really quite a snub on Eisenhower's part. It would be quite a long time before they would mend fences in any way.
Doesn't jive with I Like Ike, right?
No, I mean, but, you know, these guys all have pretty strong personalities, and they can be stubborn, I'm sure. I know Harry was, and Eisenhower was in his own way. But Harry tended to react, especially when he tended to react very viscerally to this sort of thing. I don't know if you remember the story where a critic criticized Margaret Truman singing one time in a Washington paper, and I forget, Harry said, you know, after I get done with you, you're going to need a truss or something like that. So he tended to have pretty visceral reactions to these sort of things, and Harry could hold a grudge, too. He could.
Let's go to Jen from Milwaukee. Hi, Jen.
Hello, Kathleen. Thank you for taking my call. I'm calling. This is very interesting. I love Truman as much as the one lady from Oak Creek does. We have visited his library in Independence, Missouri, at least three times on our trips to Milwaukee out to Arizona, and it's a fabulous museum. I don't know where they'd put that 53 New Yorker. They'd have to put another building up for that, but it's such a practical history of the Truman years of the war and what he did. I think he did the Marshall Plan, and it's a wonderful experience. And my husband and I do the same as Harry Truman when we cross this beautiful country of ours. We keep track of how much we spent for gas, where we ate, how much we paid for the meal.
Great.
For 20 years, and so someday our grandkids can look at it and probably compare us.
Oh, that's wonderful, Jen. Good for you. It's nice to leave that to them.
I can't say enough about the Truman Library, and I've been to a few presidential libraries, and they're all very cool. But there is something special about the Truman Library. It really is an excellent museum and such an open place. I mean, this is one of the things that Harry aspired to. He wanted to make the library, and the museum very accessible to people. And it's interesting because when Richard Nixon died, of course, there was a big fight over control of his papers and whether the federal government, the National Archives, Archive Records Administration would take them over. But the Truman Library really is one of the first modern, open, accessible presidential library. And it really wasn't until the 90s that they actually had much about Harry Truman himself in the exhibits. The exhibits tended to be on different aspects of history because Truman was kind of reluctant to make it a memorial to himself. He didn't believe in that, actually. So it took them a while, but now you can see everything about Harry Truman and the Times, and it's a great place.
Thanks, Jen. We go to Howard from Milwaukee next. Hi, Howard.
Good morning. Thanks for taking my call. First of all, I'm really glad that Harry Truman has, in many ways, been vindicated by history. When he sacked MacArthur during the Korean War, it was insanely unpopular. But MacArthur was trying to escalate the war with China and possibly the Soviet Union. And I give Truman a lot of credit for doing what was a politically very distasteful but probably appropriate choice. However, my question is how in the world could a president go across country with no Secret Service? What was the arrangement with the Secret Service? Obviously, now it'd probably be required, but did they offer to do it, and he said no thanks? I mean, what was the arrangement with the Secret Service at that time? And I'll take your comments off the air. Thank you.
Yeah, the Secret Service, I speculate in the book that the head of the Secret Service must have been quite nervous when he heard that Harry and Bess were going to drive halfway across the country and back. In 1953, ex-presidents did not receive Secret Service protection. And so when Harry and Bess left Washington on January 20th, 1953, the inauguration day, the Secret Service drove them to Union Station in Washington and shook their hands and said goodbye and put them on a train. And that was it. There was no Secret Service protection. So Harry traveled without any protection whatsoever. There was a cop in Independence, Mike Westwood was his name, a part-time cop who was allegedly a worse driver than Harry, who would occasionally, help Harry out if he needed to get around, and would walk with him a lot of times when he took his morning walks. But no, there was no Secret Service protection, and Harry didn't feel like he needed it. And it wouldn't be until the Kennedy assassination in 1963 that Congress finally authorized Secret Service protection for ex-presidents. And Harry was reluctant even then to take it, Bess even more so. But Lyndon Johnson, who was a friend of Harry's, convinced them to take the Secret Service protection. So that wasn't until 1965, actually, that the agents were assigned.
And yet when he went through some of these small towns, some of the mayors or police people would get nervous, and they would send people over to look after
him. No, when a cop, it was in Decatur, Illinois, where they stopped the first night, stayed at a motel, Parkview Motel, I think it was, and $5 a night is what the room cost, and Harry and Bess stopped at the motel, and of course word spread through town that Harry and Bess Truman were spending the night in Decatur, and the chief of police was a guy named Glenn Kerwin, and when he found out, he sent two cops over there and said, "You stay there," and they trailed Harry everywhere he went. Harry didn't like it. He said, "I don't need any protection," but the chief of police was so worried that something would happen to Harry and Bess Truman while they were in his jurisdiction that he was going to assign two cops to them the whole time, and they drove him. They stayed with him overnight. I talked to one of the cops, actually. He just sat on a folding chair outside the Truman's room that night. And they drove him to the city limits the next morning. And I'm sure Chief Kerwin breathed a sigh of relief when
I am sure that's true. You mentioned some other people. Let's talk about, because I found this fascinating, Truman's thoughts about Richard Nixon, Lyndon Johnson, Jack Kennedy, Dean Acheson.
Richard Nixon and Harry Truman did not get along. Harry Truman hated Nixon.
Well, I guess they didn't get along.
Nixon had, in 52, I mean, when they were, Nixon was Eisenhower's vice presidential candidate, Nixon all but called Truman a traitor, and the communists had infiltrated the highest levels of the government, and this infuriated Truman, and he was never able to forgive Nixon. I tell a story in the book about a photograph this I think it was a wire service photographer took at Eisenhower's inauguration, and in the photograph were Eisenhower, Nixon, and Truman, and Herbert Hoover, former president, who also attended the inauguration, and everybody had signed the photograph except Harry Truman. And the photographer actually saw Truman in New York one time, knew he would be attending this event, took the photograph and asked Harry to sign it. Harry took one look at it, said, "I'm not going to sign any picture that has that SOB Nixon in it."
Woo!
And he wouldn't sign the picture. So he and Nixon did not get along. He and Johnson got along a little better. Never quite trusted them each other. Harry never completely trusted Johnson. Harry had definite misgivings about Jack Kennedy and thought that his dad had kind of bought him the nomination. But it must be said, in both cases, when when they were the Democratic nominees, Johnson and Kennedy, Truman campaigned hard for both of them. So he always had some interesting dynamics in the political relationships he had.
Mm-hmm. Thanks very much, Howard, for the call. We go to Paul from La Crosse. And by the way, we have lines open now. They've been busy. 800-486-8655 is our number. Hello, Paul.
Good morning. It was a few years ago, I wrote a book by Gus Russo, wrote The Outfit, about the Chicago mob. And he, in the book, he described the mob's relationship with the Pendergast machine.
Mm-hmm.
And as part of the book, he was saying that Harry Truman always said that he was never part of the Pendergast machine. He had to work with them because they ran things, but he was never part of the machine. But in his book, he stated very clearly that Harry Truman played an active role in the machine itself. I'm wondering, who's, you know, other people have said the exact opposite.
Yeah.
I'm wondering, what is the truth about Harry Truman and the Pendergast?
Well, Harry Truman owed a huge political debt to the Pendergast, that's for sure. I don't know. I didn't do a lot of research on his relationship with the machine. So I really can't speak to how involved Truman was with the Pendergast machine. Now, the Pendergast were the political ruling family in Kansas City in western Missouri at this time when Harry got into politics in the 20s. And what had happened is Harry had served in the army during World War I in France with one of the Pendergast. I think his Tom was the head of the machine, and his nephew. And when Harry's business went under in 1922, the haberdashery, he was casting about for some income, for a job. And this old army buddy of his, Pendergast nephew, came up to him and said, "Why don't you run for judge?" The Pendergast machine was looking for a candidate to run for a judge in Jackson County, Missouri. And back then, a judge, it's sort of like a county commissioner. And they were looking for somebody who was a farmer and a Baptist. And Harry fit the bill, and a Mason. And Harry was a Mason as well. So they decided Harry was a good guy and that they would have him run for judge. And likewise, 12 years later, in 1934, the Pendergast machine really helped Harry get elected to the United States Senate. In fact, they called him the senator from Pendergast for many years when he was in the Senate, though he eventually distinguished himself. Harry was very loyal. Harry went to the Tom Pendergast funeral, and a lot of people said you shouldn't go to the funeral when he died. But he was very, very loyal to the Pendergast. But I really don't know how involved he was with the machine and the Pendergast, you know, inside the Pendergast organization.
Have you always been fascinated by Truman?
You know, I have. I like American presidential history, and of course, I read the David McCullough book back in the early 90s. And Truman is such a fascinating figure.
Yes,
I mean, it's hard not to like him or hate him. I mean, he really is kind of a fascinating figure in American political history. Like I said, I mean, this is a guy in 1938 was unemployed, had no prospects. Nothing more than in 1922 when he was 38 years old. And just to think in that 30 years, boy, mm-hmm. what a life. I mean, it's like he lived two completely separate lives. One, this completely ordinary American life, and then the second, this really extraordinary American life. And I always was interested, too, in his retirement and the idea of the ex-presidency. And the book gave me a chance to explore that a little bit as well.
Thanks for your call, Paul. We go next to Mary from Johnson's Creek. Hello, Mary.
Hi, Kathleen. I was one of your travelers to Lincoln's Land.
Oh, great, Mary. Thanks for calling.
My husband and my brother were in the Korean War. Through both winters, they had summer clothes. They begged for winter clothes. It was 20 and 25 degrees below zero.
Yeah, there were definite problems, especially in the beginning, I know, of the Korean War.
Well, some southern poor men lost their feet. You don't hear those things, but they were right there. My brother was a Marine, and my husband was in the Army.
Mm. One of the problems was that after World War II, basically military spending was just slashed. And so in some ways, the United States was caught unprepared for another war. The North Korean troops invaded the South, and there were terrible problems, I know, with supplies during the Korean War. And Truman took a lot of heat for that at the time. It's it's very interesting. I mean, the period kind of at the end of World War II, the demobilization, you can't blame people. I mean, we've been at war for 4 years. People were just ready to move on. And so why keep spending all this money on the military? And so the spending was reduced dramatically and in some people's estimation too much.
Let's talk a little bit about their marriage, Bess and Harry's marriage. You write, according to a family friend, theirs really was an ideal marriage. He had such nice things to say about her, even when people would call her frumpy and dowdy, mm-hmm. and Harry would stand up for her. Was it an ideal marriage?
Well, it's always hard to know, but I mean, clearly from the outside and the evidence that exists today, it was a very good marriage. I think when you're president, you're probably going to have some rough patches in your marriage with the constraints on your time and things like that. But Harry loved Bess Truman. I don't think that was that could be in dispute at all. They had met in Sunday school, but actually didn't get married until they were a little older, I think in their early 30s. There's another good story. You know, Bess came from a fairly prominent family in Independence, and Harry did not. And after they got married, they were, I think, 32, 33, and Bess said to her mother, because her mother had misgivings about Bess marrying Harry Truman, Bess said to her mother, "Don't worry, Mom, Harry's going places." And the mother said, "Well, he better hurry up." He was already in his 30s by then. And even when he became president, Mrs. Wallace, Bess's mom, had some misgivings about Harry Truman. But yeah. But Bess and Harry had a very good marriage. And hey, look, the fact that they could drive, do this big trip, just the two of them in the car for 3 weeks, 2,500 miles.
Exactly. It says a lot.
Without killing each other is probably a sign that they had a pretty good marriage.
I want to go back to phone calls, but I want you to tell, because I think that Truman made significant inroads when it came to race relations, and I found it interesting that his mother-in-law, you write, wouldn't stay in the Lincoln bedroom, that he had come from a family that had Confederate ties, and she didn't want to sleep in Abraham Lincoln's bedroom
yep.
because she thought he was too progressive on those issues.
Yep.
That was interesting.
The Wallaces, Bess's side of the family especially, were they were Confederates. I mean, Truman was born in 1884, so it's less than 20 years after the end of the Civil War.
Mm.
And then Harry lived until 1972, which is, you know, the Watergate era. It's kind of funny to think that, you know, he's so close to those two milestones in American history. But, yeah, Mrs. Wallace would not sleep in the Lincoln bedroom, refused to do it.
Isn't that something? Thanks, Mary, for your call and for going on that great trip with us. Kurt from Green Bay, hi.
Hi. Mind you, I love Harry Truman, always have, but I hope that I've got this story right, but I once saw him interviewed. And they asked him, "What do you think about Martin Luther King Jr. getting the Nobel Peace Prize?" And Harry said, "I didn't give it to him."
Yeah,
really,
Harry,
really out loud like that,
huh.
And I was rather stunned by that.
Huh.
Harry, you know, he had very complicated. I mean, Harry's own, you know, background, like we said, these were Confederates. There were Confederates in the closet there. And I think Harry's personal attitude toward race relations probably was not as progressive as his political attitude. You know, as president, he desegregated the armed forces. He was first president to address the NAACP. I mean, a very progressive attitude in race relations. But privately, I don't know if he was that progressive. And especially in his later years, I have to say, in Harry's defense, he would take these walks or go on programs. I mean, people like to goad him a little bit. He was always good for a quote. And so he would get asked a lot of questions about a lot of controversial issues that, frankly, by the time he was in his 80s, probably didn't know a lot about, didn't keep up on. And he just continued to provide good fodder, you know, for the newspapers, but probably shouldn't have been speaking as much as he did. But he did. His attitude towards civil rights demonstrators was decidedly mixed. I mean, on the one hand, he felt they were kind of rabble-rousers and that the way to achieve change was through the political system and not these demonstrations.
Mm-hmm.
So it's interesting. Yeah, he had a very complex attitude, complex legacy on race relations.
Yeah. Matthew Algio is our guest. His book is Harry Truman's Excellent Adventure, The True Story of a Great American Road Trip. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I want to talk just a few moments here. It's a great part of the book, and we urge people to go to the book. Truman's return to Washington, D.C., which is a great story, and also his first post-presidential speech that was on this road trip as well in Philadelphia.
Yeah, the ostensible purpose of the trip was to give a speech in Philadelphia to the Reserve Officers Association, Reserve Military Officers. And on the way, so they drove east from Independence and stopped in Washington first and spent a few days in Washington. And it was, it's really kind of a cool part of the trip because Harry's kind of moving around Washington and he goes to visit some senators at the Capitol one day and, you know, all the tourists are there taking pictures of the Capitol and all of a sudden Harry Truman walks by. Just the kind of thing you wouldn't really see today. And then he reconvened, in a way, his old cabinet. They had a big, big party at the Mayflower Hotel in Washington where Harry was staying. By the way, he got a reduced rate and had a big party with all his old former cabinet members there. And I point out in the book, it must have been interesting because everybody in the cabinet went on to, you know, lucrative professions. They were all businessmen or lawyers, that sort of thing. And Harry, looking around the table, it must have occurred to him that he was the least well off of anybody at the table, even though he had been the boss, so to speak. And then he went up to Philadelphia, gave a speech at the Bellevue Stratford Hotel, and in that speech, he really, really let Eisenhower have it. Ironically, really what he railed against Eisenhower and the Republicans for was big military cuts. The Republicans at the time favored cutting military spending, and the Democrats favored increasing military spending. I guess things have switched around a little bit, I guess. I don't know. But that was the speech, the first speech of his ex-presidency, his first post-presidential speech, and kind of set the tone for his ex-presidency that he was going to be pugnacious. He wasn't going to go quietly, and he would stay involved in controversial political issues.
Mm-hmm. And as you write, the ex-presidency was turned into a bully pulpit in its own right from Truman.
Yeah, Truman, it's interesting. Everybody calls Jack Kennedy, John F. Kennedy, the first television president. But really, Harry Truman was the first television ex-president. He was the first ex-president, really, in the modern age of mass media. I mean, the only other ex-president at the time was Herbert Hoover, and he didn't really do a lot of political speaking. And before that, you have to go back, you know, I mean, Roosevelt had been president so long that there were really no other ex-presidents around. And so Harry kind of shaped what the modern ex-presidency has become, this kind of bully pulpit, like you said, where you give your opinions on things or you try to, you know, attack issues, that sort of thing. So it really set the tone for what ex-presidents do.
Dick from Waukesha. Hi, Dick.
Hi, Kathleen. Guest. I want to go back to the atom bomb. My wife and I never agreed on this, but I think had Truman not authorized its use, we wouldn't know from experience what the results could be. And somewhere down the line and all the crises we've had since then, some ruler might have said, well, I'm going to push the button. What do you think of that?
Yeah, I mean, It's a point worth considering. It was such a terrific, you know, and I mean that as a terrible, horrific weapon, and the results were so horrific that in a way, I guess it might have awakened people to the terrible potential of this weapon. And you know, it's kind of amazing in some ways when you think about it that it's since 1945 and still have never ever one a nuclear weapon has never been used. Since then, and maybe that's one of the reasons why. I don't know.
Thank you so much, Dick, for your call. Phyllis from Waupaca. Hi.
Hi. There was one quote that I read from Harry Truman that really stood out to me, and he was giving a speech, and he said, how many times do you have to be hit on the head before you realize who's hitting you? And I think that's still true in politics today, that many times we don't realize who's on our side and who's not on our side. Thank you.
I haven't heard that one before, but that definitely sounds like something that Harry would say. It's really interesting looking back at some of his old speeches, exactly how blunt he was. I saw an old video of him campaigning in 1948 in the Whistle Stop campaign, and basically he said to the crowd, if you vote for the Republicans, you'll get what you deserve. And you're dumb for doing it. you'd never see a politician go out and basically tell the voters you're dumb if you do anything. But he was a blunt guy. He really was.
Yeah. Thanks so much for the call. Well, Matthew, thank you so much for being with us. Your book is a real treasure. I hope it gets read widely. It's so nicely done. It was a great idea and packed with all kinds of historical information as well. So
thank you.
What more
thank you,
can Kathy. You ask for?
it was a lot of fun writing the book, and it's been a lot of fun spending the past hour with you.
Yeah, and with you as well. Thank you. Matthew Algeo is his name. You spell his last name A-L-G-E-O. His first book was Last Team Standing, How the Steelers and the Steagles Saved Pro Football During World War II. And this book, Harry Truman's Excellent Adventure, The True Story of a Great American Road Trip. It was fun to talk to him. Thanks to Cynthia Schuster for producing, Rhonda Fanning for on-air production.